Several years ago, some of you might remember a commercial on television for the MasterCard credit card. And the tagline was, "Master the possibilities." Well, this morning, I would like to use that phrase, but change it just a little bit. Because with Jesus, in particular this text we see today, we see him mastering the impossible. And this is actually a theme that recurs throughout this final full year of Jesus' ministry. We have now been studying his life and in earthly ministry for about 10 or 11 months now. We started late last year with his birth, and we've been focusing on these 3-plus years of his ministry. It has been challenging at times keeping the chronology straight. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are not always written with chronology as their most important theme, but John gives us some milestones along the way that helps us out, particularly the Passovers. Passover was a celebration that the Jews commemorated once a year. It was, I guess you could say, similar in our culture to the 4th of July, in that it marked their independence from Egypt when Moses led them out of slavery. It occurred in the spring of the year, and John specifically mentions 3 Passovers in his gospel. John chapter 2, verses 13 and 23, he says the Passover of the Jews was at hand. Our text this morning, John 6, 4, now the Passover, the feast of the Jews was at hand. And then we'll see later in John 11, 55, now the Passover of the Jews was at hand. Now, in addition to these 3 Passovers, it is thought, most scholars agree that there was an additional year in the Lord's ministry between the first and the second Passovers that are specifically mentioned. And it may be that in John 5, 1, when John simply says a feast of the Jews, that may have been that Passover in between those 2 years. Now, since we know that the baptism of Jesus by John the Baptist in the beginning of his public ministry preceded the first Passover, and we know that his ministry, in fact, his earthly life, ended at a Passover, we can come to the conclusion that Jesus' ministry was about 3 to 3.5 years in length. It began probably in the summer or fall of AD 29, and it culminated in the Passover of AD 33. Now again, it's very difficult sometimes to put everything in the 4 Gospels in a strictly chronological order, because not all of the Gospels record all of the events of his life. But what we have this morning, here in John chapter 6, is the one miracle Jesus performed that all 4 Gospels record. There's only one, and this is it. And it is put in the context, as we mentioned, of the Passover. The Passover was near. And I believe that this Passover is the Passover of 32 AD. We saw last week that John the Baptist was beheaded by Herod Antipas, probably at the end of 31 or the beginning of 32. So it leads into this particular year. And we're coming into the final full year of Jesus' ministry. And what you see here in these last 12 months is an increase in the spectacular. Some of Jesus' most powerful miracles he performed during this last year of his ministry. So you see on the one hand his popularity growing, but you also see the tension growing. You even see it a little bit at the end of our text this morning. And then as we go on another Sunday, looking later in chapter 6, we see tension among Jesus' followers. And it's going to continue to build as the antagonism toward Jesus of the Jewish leaders rises. until we come to those fateful events of the next Passover, which came to the end of Jesus' life here on earth. So we're calling this new section of our series in Jesus' life a master like no other. Throughout this final year, Jesus is very deliberate about where he goes and when, and the things that he does, and who he does them in front of. Now, we had mentioned, we'd read already chapter 6 of John. I will be referring on a few occasions to the other gospel accounts, but we're going to stay primarily here in John chapter 6 for this morning. We begin with what I'm calling the monumental responsibility. Now, we had seen last Sunday that the context of this is the death of John the Baptist. John the Baptist had bravely taken a stand against the immorality of Herod Antipas and his wife Herodias, who was also his half-sister and niece. If that throws you for a loop, you got to listen to last week's message. But he stood up against that and repeatedly called them out and said, "What you're doing is wrong." And eventually it cost him his life. And we're told that when Jesus heard of the death of John the Baptist, he withdrew to a solitary place. He wanted to get away from the crowds. He wanted to get away from everybody. I'm sure that even though Jesus was God, he was human and he had feelings. And hearing that his cousin, the promised forerunner, John the Baptist, had been killed in that way, emotionally, I'm sure that he was shaken. Even as many of us were this last week when we heard of the latest mass shooting and the number of victims that's coming across the TV and radio. Jesus needed to get away. He needed to collect his thoughts. I think he needed to spend some time alone in prayer. And so he leads his disciples across the Sea of Galilee and into the mountains. It's a place known today as the Golan Heights. Those of you that are following what's happening in the Middle East, you know that's a territory that Israel won during the Six-Day War in 1967. It's a disputed area between Israel and Lebanon. It's a strategic area because of its height. You can see for many miles and know what's happening on either side of the border. But this is the area to which Jesus took his disciples trying to get away. But it didn't work out that way. The crowds that had been following Jesus saw where he was going. They saw him get in the boat and head to the other side. And it says that they followed them on foot. They went across the northern edge of the Sea of Galilee and were watching for where they would land. And when Jesus got there and he got his disciples and he got them up into the mountains, this huge throng of people followed them. Now, I don't know about you, but I probably wouldn't have reacted too well to that. When I'm fatigued and when I'm stressed out, when I've got a lot on my mind and my emotions are all up in the air, the last thing I want is to see a whole bunch of people around. Think about it when you're at work, right? It's about an hour or so before quitting time. Maybe it's a Friday and you're looking forward to the weekend. You've got some plans. And you just can't wait to get out. It's been a long week. It's been a long day. You're just counting down the minutes until it's quitting time. And the boss comes by and says, "I'm going to need you to work late tonight." Or maybe you've had that vacation that you've been looking for so long, and something interrupts, something comes up at the last minute. That's what's happening here with Jesus. And don't tell me that he didn't have those feelings because he was human. But rather than allowing himself to be irritated, we're told that Jesus was moved with compassion. He looks out at these people and he sees them as sheep without a shepherd. And sheep without a shepherd are lost. Sheep need a shepherd. More than any animal on earth, sheep need somebody to take care of them and to lead them. And Jesus looked out and he saw these multitudes who were clueless spiritually, but they had such a great desire that they were coming and they were following him. And so he decided, I'm going to teach. I'm going to instruct them. I'm going to share the truth with them. And he began to teach, and apparently he taught all day. And it's starting to get toward late afternoon, coming toward dinner time. The disciples, you know, they're looking for a break too. And they were a bit irritated. They come to him, we're told in Mark chapter 6, in his record of the accounts. By this time it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him. This is a remote place, they said. It's already late. Send the people away so they can go to the surrounding countryside and the villages and buy themselves something to eat. Now, that sounded rational enough, didn't it? I mean, it's getting late. There aren't any stores around here. Why don't you send them to these villages around the Sea of Galilee and they can get something to eat? And the unspoken part of it is, and they can leave us alone, right? You know that was on their minds. And then Jesus turns and says, you give them something to eat. Now talk about an unexpected turn of events. Now here the disciples are asking for relief, and Jesus piles on more responsibility. We learn later that this crowd numbered 5,000 men. That's just the men. And I'm sure there were women and children there as well. We know of at least one child, right? One little boy had a lunch. The estimates are anywhere between 15 and 20,000 people were gathered there on the mountainside. And Jesus tells his 12 disciples, you give them something to eat. That is a monumental responsibility. Now, sometimes the same thing can happen to us. Maybe not that drastic. But sometimes life here on planet Earth can become a demoralizing struggle. The challenges loom larger than our meager resources. The demands far outweigh our ability to meet them. And some of the answers are just out there beyond our intellectual reach. Some problems are just too complex to solve. Let's face it, the world is big. We're small. To make matters worse, we're naturally predisposed to think only on the horizontal plane. We're trying to figure out how I can do this or how we can do this collectively. Very rarely do we bring God into the picture. Now, we all say and we all know that nothing is impossible for God, but we habitually think in terms of what we have to offer and what we can do, what can be accomplished through natural means. And that's what was happening to the disciples here. Now, I'm fascinated with the multiple responses that you find in the text. The problem was how to meet the needs of such a vast crowd of people, and you find four solutions being proposed. First, you have the disciples, who I think were a bit ruthless in their response. They're saying, basically, get rid of the problem. Jesus, you've got all these people and they need to be fed. Send them away. It's not our problem. They need to take care of themselves. You know, they saw themselves just at the wrong place, the wrong time. Nothing could be done about it. We can't do anything, so just make the problem go away. With that approach, they'd have made ideal committee members, right? Someone once defined a committee as a group of people who individually can do nothing and collectively decide that nothing can be done, right? And that's what these guys are doing. Ah, can't do it. Throw up our hands. No way. Can't be done. But how unlike their master they were. His heart went out to them. Their hearts were cold. They were thinking of their own needs first. I wonder sometimes how much we're like them. Now, the second response we see comes from Philip. He was rational. Jesus turns to Philip and asks, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" Now, we wonder, why is Jesus picking on Philip? And there was a good reason why he would ask. Philip was from Bethsaida, which was probably the nearest village to where they were. He was kind of the hometown boy, and he would know where the markets were. He would know where you could buy bread and other food. So there was, you know, there was that angle to it. But John gives us a little insight here. There's another reason why Jesus picked on Philip. It says here he was testing him. Jesus knew what he was going to do, but he wanted to see how Philip would respond. So he's giving him a test here. Unfortunately, Philip failed the test. You'll notice he didn't even answer the question. Jesus said, "Where can we go to get bread?" He answered, "How much would it cost?" And Philip was the mathematician of the group. I'm definitely not like Philip in that regard. But he sat down and kind of figured it out, counted the cost, you might say. And he said, "We would need the equivalent of 200 days' wages to feed this crowd, and that would just be for a bite." Now, with the limited math skills that I have and a handy calculator, let's say that your job pays you $12.50 an hour. Now, it's not minimum wage. I know a lot of you maybe make more than that, but let's just figure $12.50 an hour. For an 8-hour day, you earn $100. That's why I picked that particular wage, easy to work with. In 200 days, at $100 a day, you would earn $20,000. That's what Philip comes up with in our terms. Jesus, it would take $20,000 to buy enough bread for all these people, and they just get a bite. Now, if there are 5,000 men, $20,000. That means you could go to Steak and Shake and get them $4 meals, right? And pass them out. Well, that's not too bad, except remember that that's just the men. So if you've got a man with his wife and a child or two or three, they got to split that $4 meal between them. That's where he says they're only going to get a bite. There's not enough. It can't be done. A.W. Tozer comments, "Philip revealed the type of mind that is altogether earthly, uninspired, and uninspiring. He reached for his calculator, pressed the on switch, and went to work. I call him Philip the Calculator. There was a need for a miracle, but Philip set out to calculate the odds. Probably every Christian group has at least one person with a calculator. I've sat on boards for many years, and rarely is there a board without a Philip the Calculator among its members. When you suggest something, out comes the calculator to prove that it can't be done. If Jesus and the other disciples had listened only to Philip, they and the multitude would have starved to death in the wilderness, and this glorious miracle wouldn't have taken place." And that's true. Probably every group has what they call the statistical pessimist. The one who adds it all up and says, "Nope, it can't be done." You know, Philip should have known by this time that God never calls his people to accomplish something without also providing the means to do it. We read from the other Gospels that the disciples had just been out on a preaching tour. Jesus had divided them up in pairs and said, "I want you to go out to these towns and I want you to preach. Tell them about the kingdom of God." And he gave them power to heal diseases and to drive out demons. And they came back to him and said, "Wow, Lord, you wouldn't believe the things that were happening here." He said, "Well, of course I believe it. I gave you the power to do it." And yet, here comes a situation. Here comes an impossible situation. And Philip says, "Oh, can't be done." You know, a correct response would have been, "I don't know yet, Lord, but I know you'll think of something." He was limiting himself to what he could do and what he could figure. Now, third, we see Andrew. Andrew was resourceful in his response. While Philip was calculating, Andrew was moving through the crowd trying to find something. Is there anything that we have here that we can use? And what he comes up with is a little boy with a little lunch. Everything about Andrew's statement emphasizes inadequacy. The Greek word here for boy is a double diminutive. It means little boy. We're talking about a young lad. How's he gonna help? He talks about these five loaves of bread. Now we're thinking, you know, Wonder Bread, right? We're thinking big old loaf of bread, nicely sliced. You know, we find some peanut butter, we'd be in good shape. That's not the kind of bread we're talking about here. These were barley loaves. Barley was the grain for the poor people. These are people that couldn't afford wheat bread. They had barley bread. And they're probably about the size of a dinner roll. Some even think they were flat, like flatbread. But just small size. We're not talking about a great big loaf of bread here. And then you've got the two fish. I know some of you guys out there fish, right? You've got your fish stories, you know. Every time you tell them, they get a little bit bigger. You ever hear about the one-armed fisherman? Caught a fish that long? You'll get it eventually. We're not talking about great big catfish here or nice salmon. These are like sardines. These are little pickled fish that were taken along as more of a relish to choke down the dry barley bread with. So you're looking at five dinner rolls and two sardines. That's the lunch that Jesus was presented. Now, Philip was the man that said, the situation's hopeless, nothing can be done. Andrew was the man who said, I'll see what I can do and I'll trust Jesus to do the rest. Now, before we ask God to do the impossible, I think we need to start with the possible and we need to give him what we have. One of the lessons we learned this morning in Sunday school was it's not enough to just say, okay, God, you do it. I'll sit back and watch. God expects us to get involved. He expects us to do all that we can do, to give all that we can give. But understand that it doesn't stop there. We do what we can do, we give what we can give, and we let Jesus take care of the rest. And that's where we come to the fourth response from Jesus, what I'm calling the miraculous resolution. He looked at the situation not as a problem, but as an opportunity to trust the Father and to glorify his name. And that's what an effective leader does. He's someone who sees potential in problems and is willing to step out in faith. You know, acting on the basis of human wisdom, his disciples saw the problem. They didn't see the potential. You know, how many times do you hear people say, oh, if only we had enough money, we could do something? The first step is not just to measure our resources, but to determine what God's will is and then trust him to meet the need. Now, according to all four gospel accounts, Jesus took this little boy's lunch, he blessed it, meaning he prayed over it, he broke it, and he handed it to his disciples, and they fed the crowd. Now, I want you to notice the miracle here takes place in the hands of Jesus, not the disciples. He is distributing it out, and that's where the multiplication takes place. He just keeps giving and giving and giving and giving. You know, some skeptics have tried to explain away that this event wasn't even a miracle. I read one view that the miracle took place in people's hearts. You know, they saw the little boy give their lunch to Jesus and they said, "Oh, isn't that cute? We ought to do the same thing." So they got their lunches out and shared with people around them who didn't. And that's what they call the miracle of this text. A second view is that it should be regarded as something like communion, where you just get a little piece of bread, and it's symbolic. It's not really a meal. The problem with that is all four Gospels say that the people ate to their fill. They got full. I don't know about you, but have you ever gotten full on what we serve for communion? How many of you say, I'm going to skip breakfast this morning because they're going to have communion at church and I can fill up there? Not here, I can guarantee you. You could even double dip and you wouldn't get enough to fill you up. It just doesn't fit what the Bible says. And trust me, they would not have wanted to make him king if one of those two things had happened. No, this was something spectacular. This was something miraculous. This was something altogether unexpected and unexplainable. Now, before we apply here what we've learned, I do want to look at the final two verses in John's account, verse 14 and 15. After the people saw the miraculous sign Jesus did, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who's come into the world." And you think, yeah, Jesus made his point. He fed all these people, they're satisfied. We're told that 12 basketfuls were left over. How many disciples were there? 12. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think they each had a basket that they were distributing the food out of to the people. And when they were done, the baskets were still full. They even had something to eat. This is a miracle. Jesus has mastered the impossible right in front of their eyes. And the people respond saying, "Oh, this is it. This is the one. This is the Messiah. This is the one that has been promised all of these years." And we think, yay, this is great. This is exactly what Jesus wanted. Keep reading. Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him a king by force, withdrew again to the mountain by himself. See, he saw the effect on the crowds. And he knew they were going to try to make a political king out of him. See, there were very fierce nationalistic longings among the Jews, especially in Galilee. That was a hotbed for the nationalism, saying we want to be rid of Rome. We want to have our own land. We want to be independent. And doubtless many of those who saw the miracle felt that here it is. Here's our guy. This is the one. If he did that with this little lunch, just think of what he could do in other situations. So they wanted to make him king. They wanted to use him to further their own ends. But you know, Jesus, in this occasion and several others that we've seen and will continue to see through his ministry, he saw the prospect of an earthly kingdom as nothing more than a temptation. Remember, Satan took him up on the high mountain and he showed him all the kingdoms of the world and he said, "I'll give them all to you. You can be king of the world if you'll bow down and worship me." And Jesus said, "No, you only worship God." He rejected all of the kingdoms. On many occasions, the Jews wanted him to be king. And he said, "No." It amazes me when I hear these preachers and teachers say, "Well, Jesus came to be their king, and if the Jews would just have accepted him as their king, you know, it would have been perfect." No. That's not why he came. He did not come this time to set up a kingdom. Now, that didn't make him any less king. That didn't make him any less God. But that's not why he came. They tried to make him king, and he wouldn't take it. Because he knew their hearts. He knew that it was not a spiritual kingdom they had in mind. It was for their own political, their own materialistic goals and objectives. He didn't have any part of that. Now, what can we learn from this miracle? Let's begin with this. God is the God of the impossible. I want you to consider a few other verses. You don't have to turn to them. You might want to jot them down, look at them later. Four verses, two from the Old Testament, two from the New Testament. Very simple. They don't even need further explanation. Just listen. Two are in the same chapter. Jeremiah 32, verse 17. Ah, sovereign Lord, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and your outstretched arm. Nothing is too hard for you. 10 verses later, verse 27. Now God is speaking. I am the Lord, the God of all mankind. Is anything too hard for me? Jeremiah answered that one 10 verses earlier. No, nothing. I ask you, are there any exceptions to that statement? No. Nothing is impossible for God. Luke 1:37, now in the New Testament. This is when the angel Gabriel is coming to Mary and saying, you're going to bear the Son of God. And he ends with verse 37, nothing is impossible with God. I ask again, are there any exceptions there? Is there any room for interpretation? You say, well, you know, maybe this. No. I know people try to come up with these, you know, hypothetical situations. Could God create a rock so big he couldn't move? No. It's ridiculous. You have to go outside the realm of rationality to come up with something that is impossible for God. And then Luke 18:27. This is from the words of Jesus. What is impossible with men is possible with God. And maybe that's the verse we really need to remember in this context, because it was impossible for the men. There's no way that the disciples could feed those people. But with God, nothing is impossible. Now, I do want you to notice, who fed the people? Was it Jesus handing out the food? No, it was the disciples. Jesus used them to complete the miracle. And he wants to do the same through us. Yes, God can do all things, but he chooses to do things on earth through us. Very rarely does he send his angels anymore to do his will, because he has us. And he wants to work through us. He wants to do the impossible through you and me. Do you believe that? Do you believe that he can? Do you believe that he will? See, like the disciples back in the first century, we are all faced with a series of great opportunities brilliantly disguised as impossible situations. We think they're impossible, other people around us think they're impossible, but I guarantee you there's one person who doesn't hold that view, and that's your Lord and Savior. For nothing is impossible with God. I think this episode in the life of Christ teaches us to have compassion on people, to look at problems as opportunities for God to work, and to give him all that we have, no matter how little that might be, and trust him to meet the needs. If we do all we can, I firmly believe he will step in and do the rest. And I want to end with some encouraging news. God's faithfulness has never depended on the faithfulness of his children. He's faithful even when we aren't. When we lack courage, he doesn't. You know, he's made a history of using people in spite of themselves. We read about it all the time in the scriptures. God's blessings come through his grace, not according to the depth of our faith. As 2 Timothy 2:13 promises, if we are faithless, he remains faithful, for he cannot deny himself. So the next time you face an impossibility, leave it in the hands of the specialist. Turn to the God of the impossible. Refuse to calculate. Refuse to doubt. Refuse to worry. Refuse to try to work it out all by yourself. Stand against that. Instead, say, Lord, I'm carrying on something I can't handle. This seems impossible to me, but it says nothing to you. And that's the secret of mastering the impossible.